Alvin Plantinga, as I've said, has done a tremendous job in marshaling the free will defense. What's the difference between a defense and a theodicy? A defense is a response to the problem of evil, which is merely possibly the case. You tell a story as to how God and evil, in the amounts, distribution, etc., we see in the world, how these things could be possible. Your story doesn't have to be true. It could well be false. But it merely has to be possible. Because if it's possible, then it shows that God and evil are not logically inconsistent. A theodicy, on the other hand, is a story about God and evil and how it's not only possible for God and evil to exist in a world, but you tell the story in such a way that the theodicy you give is actually believable. It's rationally justified in believing the story. You give the theodicy in such a way, it's a story about God and evil that's credible. It's believable, not merely possibly true, but in fact probably true, or at least for all that we know, not irrational to believe it, not irrational to accept it as true. And so that's the difference between a defense and a theodicy. Plantinga is doing a defense. He's using the free will defense. He's showing that if humans, by God's design, are to have free will with respect to at least some of their significant actions, then it could well be the case that they could use that free will to perform good or to perform evil actions. Unfortunately, they have, the story that he gives goes, they have performed evil actions, and so evil has entered the world, in fact, in the amount that we see in the world. But that doesn't denigrate or take away from the fact that God exists and has, in fact, created us with that freedom. And so, in effect, Plantinga's telling this story. So I've said that he tries to show that the statement, number one, God is omnipotent, omniscient, and wholly good, and statement two, there is evil in the world, that those two statements are, in fact, not inconsistent, and in fact, consistent. The way in which you show one proposition P, say proposition 1, and another proposition Q, for example, our proposition 2, the way in which you show two propositions, P and Q, to be consistent is to produce a third proposition, say R, we'll call it R, whose conjunction with P is consistent and entails Q. As he goes on to say, R, of course, this third proposition, need not be true or known to be true. It need not be so much as plausibly true or plausible. All you need is it to have that relationship to P and Q. Namely, when you put P and R together, they're consistent, and in fact, they entail Q. At the heart of the free will defense is, of course, human freedom. But how are we to define human freedom? What should we say about its characteristics? Well, Plantinga attempts to define it in this way. A person is free with respect to some action if it's the case that the person can perform that action or refrain from performing that action. The idea is that there's no compelling reason or conditions that necessitate the person to perform that action. So if I say that I'm free with respect or free to take a drink of the cup on my desk, that means that at this moment, there's no causal laws, no antecedent conditions that go before my action that compel me to take a drink of water. there may be some reasons for thinking I might be motivated when I think of the water to take a drink. For example, I'm thirsty. But that doesn't take away from freedom completely. Of course, your needs at a present time do influence your freedom, but they don't necessitate my taking a drink. I could well say, no, I'm not going to drink from the cup at that time. So I'm free, I say, philosophically, I'm free with respect to that action, taking a drink from the cup. Now, an action is morally significant for a person at a given time if it would be wrong for that person to perform the action then, but right to refrain, or vice versa. In other words, it's morally significant, morally laden with value. He gives it going 30 miles an hour over the speed limit. That's a morally significant action. Or perhaps, too, crossing the road without looking both ways. All these are morally significant actions. Still, he says, suppose we say that a person is significantly free on a given occasion. If he is then free with respect to an action that is morally significant for him. Okay, Planica's definition of significantly free means that that person is free with respect to a morally significant action. So we've combined the first two definitions that we've given here. And so, to give a preliminary statement of the free will defense, Planica says the following. A world containing free creatures is, in God's eyes, a much more valuable thing, other things being equal, than a world not containing free human moral creatures. But if those free creatures have the possession of free will, which is given by God's creative hand, then it's possible, if they do and are able to face morally significant actions and do so in a significantly free way, that is, they're free to perform or to refrain from morally significant actions. And if God desires a world like that, and as we've said, a world containing creatures who are sometimes significantly free is more valuable than a world containing no free creatures at all. But if they are truly free with respect to those actions, then they might go wrong with respect to them, and therefore there might be evil in such a world. It's a sad history and a sad fact, but in fact, human creatures have misused their freedom and gone wrong with respect to it, therefore causing evils in the world. And so that's the end of the story. The story is like Proposition R. We've come up with a story such that when combined with God as omnipotent, omniscient, and wholly good, it's not consistent with, in fact, it's consistent with, there is evil in the world. And therefore, you tell the story, it's consistent with one of the propositions, and together it entails that the other proposition, namely, there is evil in the world. Therefore, Planiga is victorious in his free will defense. In short, that's the way the free will defense goes. Now, we remember Mackey's claim. Mackey claimed that if it's possible for God to create a human being such that the human being is free on one occasion, then certainly it's possible, Mackey thought, that God could create a human being such that they would be free on several, and in fact all occasions, occasions of morally significant action, and in fact they'd be free and freely do the right thing. And therefore, God could create that set of people such that they could always freely do rightly. That's the objection that Planiga is trying to respond to. And so the question Planiga asks is, which worlds could God have created? Mackey thought that God could create any old world that he pleased. But it seems to me that Mackey was wrong in this, and that that does not count against God's omnipotence. Why doesn't that count against God's omnipotence? Well, in short, let me read a quotation from Planiga's works. And he says this. He's talking about whether or not God could both cause me to perform some action A, say, eating an apple. Could God cause me to eat an apple? Cause me, I mean, actually, literally determine me to and compel me to eat an apple at a certain time. And also, it could be true at the same time, with respect to that eating of the apple, that I do so freely. The heart of the free will defense is that those two are in fact incompatible. Either I am caused to eat the apple by God, another being outside me, or I myself initiate, approve of, intend to determine myself to eat the apple. That's the heart. Is God determining me to eat the apple, or am I determining myself in my freedom to eat the apple? And so Plantinga says, quote, God cannot cause it to be the case that I freely refrain from an action A. For if he does so, he causes it to be the case that I refrain from A, in which case I do not do so freely. Okay? So a person can't freely eat an apple and yet at the same time be altogether determined and caused to eat that apple by the divine being. Now we have to discuss just for a moment this idea of human freedom. A lot of times philosophers, especially analytic philosophers, make a distinction between two types of properties when we talk about the properties of a human being. Some properties are essential to a human being. Essential to a human being, for example, a human's genetic code seems to be essential to them, but the length of my fingernails does not seem to be essential to me. What is an essential property? Well, it's this. An essential property of some being X is such that if you take away that property, X will cease to exist, or cease to be the sort of being that it is. Okay? So if you take away my genetic code, if suddenly nothing in my body had that code, I would cease to be the sort of being that I am. However, if you clip my fingernails, or cut off my hair, or perhaps broke my little pinky on my right hand, those are only accidental properties of me. The length of my hair and nails and the condition of my bone in my right pinky, those are just accidental properties, non-essential properties. Question is this, is it essential to human beings that they sin after they are created? Because after all, when we use the free will defense, what we're saying is that, in effect, Adam and the race that came after him have freely turned away from God and freely gone their own way and freely sinned against God. But was it necessary that they should do that? And the answer here is no. Plantinga thinks that God created the world, and God in his omniscience knew what would take place, but in his omniscience he doesn't cause everything in the world to go the way that it does. Because after all, what we've said is that God wants us freely to turn to him in love, adoration, repentance, and service. And so it can't be essential to human beings that they sin after they created, or essential to them that they are absolutely immaculate and without sin. Rather, it's an accidental property of humans that they do sin. Romans tells us that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But it's not absolutely necessary that a human being should sin after they're created. It's merely a contingent or accidental property. In fact, we believe that Jesus Christ was perfectly man and perfectly God, and yet without sin. He had all the essential properties of being a human being, and yet he did not sin in the human nature. Therefore, it's not essential to human beings that they sin after they're created or come to exist in the world. Now, reading Plantinga's articles on God and evil become very difficult at times. He marshals all the deep philosophical, analytical elements of logical argumentation. Don't be thrown by that. I just hope and encourage you that you'll keep going on, understand what you can, go back as time permits, and hopefully the taped lecture here will help to direct you to the important elements of your study. Now, in the middle of Plantinga's development, he brings up this notion of trans-world depravity. Trans-world depravity. What is Plantinga getting at with respect to this notion? Well, it's this. So far we said that God, even if omnipotent, cannot actualize, cannot create just any old world he pleases. That's false. Because, after all, God has given us significant freedom. God knows perfectly what will take place, that is, what we'll do in our freedom. The elements of his omniscience include, I believe, knowledge of future free actions, future contingents, as they're sometimes called. However, it's not the case that God compels us to go wrong with respect to our actions just because he knows what we're going to do. But we come to this notion of trans-world depravity. In the logical problem of evil, we pretty much have to come up with a solution, our story, this free will defense that Plantinga deals with. We have to come up with this notion in such a way that it had sort of universal applicability. That is, God could have created any world in which I exist or in which human beings exist, such that those human beings, it is possible, would go free with, would go wrong freely with respect to at least one free and significantly free action. So in other words, God chooses which human beings he will make, which human beings he'll create. And yet, he doesn't know ahead of time, until they're in the world and in an environment, he doesn't know with respect to actual time what the human beings will do in their freedom, how they'll mix together, and how they will bring about right or wrong actions. Now, we have to be careful with respect to this. The idea, after all, in the free will defense is that human beings are responsible for their actions, freely performed actions. If they're compelled by some force that they can't overcome, then they're probably, most of the time, not responsible, unless they've brought about that force upon themselves. A drunk, for example, behind the wheel, might claim that I couldn't have stopped because my nervous system was not responsive enough, quick enough, to avoid hitting the person on the sidewalk. But they were the ones who brought themselves to be in that state. So therefore, we do attribute guilt and blame to them, and rightly so. But what if you were created and brought into the world and just caused to perform bad actions, and you had no choice, no possibility of reprieve from those actions? The person, I believe, would not be responsible in a strong sense of the word, because they were created, hardwired, to perform in that way. So let me correct the way in which I spoke about God's knowledge. God creates S, a set of people in the world, and God knows full well what those people will do in the world. Okay, he knows full well the way in which they'll use their freedom. But the idea is that it's a contingent reality about each person, that it's possible, since they have significantly free freedom and they're gonna face moral situations, it's at least possible. This is the heart now of the free will defense. It's at least possible that human beings, no matter which one God creates, which set of human beings, that each one of them will go freely wrong. That is, they'll go wrong, they'll perform a wrong, morally repugnant action freely and do so freely with respect to at least one moral action. But then we come to the reality or the claim of transworld depravity. And it comes down to this, that it's at least possible. It's at least possible that for any world God should create, that for any world God should create or actualize, that people, the people that he creates, will go wrong, will face a moral action, but fall short in their moral duty. They'll perform a morally repugnant action and do so freely with respect to that action. They'll do so freely, and they'll do so in any world in which God actualizes those people. All you need, once again, for the free will defense to be successful is a story that's at least possible. And what Plantinga has shown is that it's at least possible that for any human individual God creates, that person could go wrong with respect to some moral action. Therefore, it's simply an empirical fact. It's an empirical quandary that when we look out into the world, that there is evil is simply accidental and empirical. We have to look and see how people are doing. The fact is, no matter what Plantinga claims, the fact is that it's possible that no matter what world, what set of people, human individuals with freedom that God creates, that every human individual, it is possible that every human individual will go wrong and do so freely with respect to at least one moral action. If this is the case, and I believe it is, and Plantinga has won the day, then Plantinga is in fact successful. He has rebutted the logical problem of evil, for he has shown that God is omniscient, omnipotent, and wholly good, and there is evil in the world, is in fact consistent. How has he shown that? Well, he's produced a proposition whose conjunction with God is omniscient, omnipotent, and wholly good, namely the conjunction every essence, every human essence, every human individual, suffers from transworld depravity. And when you put those together, when you put God's character being the way we believe it to be, and every essence human suffers from transworld depravity, when you put that together, and God creates a world with human essences, then what is entailed? Well, there is evil. Because God is the way he is, he creates a world, but it's a world full of human essences, and every human essence suffers from transworld depravity, which just means that in any world in which they exist, it's possible that they perform evil. And the sad truth is that in our world, it's possible, and in fact actual, that human beings perform evil. Not only in our world, but in every world, it's possible that people, just as they did in this world, might perform bad actions. Therefore, Plantinga wins the day. He shows that it's at least possible. It's a defense, after all. It's at least possible, using the notion of free will and significant freedom, that God could be who he is in his splendor, in his omnipotence and omniscience and whole goodness. And yet there could be evil in the amounts that we find in this world to be the case. Plantinga is a tough person to read and understand, but I trust that after our conversation and your reading that it will become clear. Consult the study guide questions. Perhaps it'll help to clarify what you need, the distinctions you need to make clear, to really understand Plantinga. Also consult the introductions or prefaces to the textbooks for the course for further help on understanding Plantinga's free will defense and how it successfully rebuts J.L. Mackey's article, Omnipotence and Evil. Plantinga has also brought in an interesting question, an interesting response to a question that might arise in your mind. For example, we've talked about human beings performing evil in that it's possible that any human being God could create, might perform evil in the world. But we've called that earlier in the course moral evil. What about natural evil? Evil arising, pain states within sentient beings, animals and humans, arising from tornadoes, hurricanes, and floods. What about those? Now, Plantinga ingeniously says the following. What you do is you ascribe those evils to Satan, or Satan and his cohorts, because Satan, in Christian tradition, is also a free-willed being, as are the demons. In fact, they've freely turned away from God to serve themselves. And so if you ascribe natural evil to Satan and his cohorts, then you explain all evils, both moral and natural, by means of the misuse of significantly free beings. Moral evil comes about largely through human agency, the misuse of freedom God gave them. Natural evil, on the other hand, according to Plantinga, comes about by Satan, or Satan and his cohorts. In their evil, wicked intentions, they bring about floods, tornadoes, and earthquakes. And therefore, you have attributed all evil to free-willed beings. That is ingenious. Once again, not everyone might accept that. Some people don't even believe in the personal agency of Satan, the personal existence of Satan. Therefore, this will not act for them as a theodicy. Augustine thought that it was a theodicy for him. But for someone who doesn't accept that Satan even exists, say, or that he's not a personal power in the world, this would not act as a theodicy in any way, but merely a defense. A defense, after all, merely has to be possibly true. It could even be false that Satan existed in the world as a personal agent. For that person who believes that, they could still see this as a successful defense, because it's at least possible that there could be a being named Satan who could cause tornadoes, earthquakes, and hurricanes, and do so freely. If that's at least possible, then everyone can agree, and I think we can agree it is possible, then everyone can agree that Plantinga is successful. He's shown that all evils could be, that it's possible that all evils are the result of the misuse of freedom in agents that God has created. This is the end of 5.